When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. If you love listening to this show as much as I love hosting it, I think you'll really like the Medal of Honor podcast, produced in partnership with the Medal of Honor Museum. Each episode talks about a genuine American hero and the actions that led to their receiving our nation's highest award for valor. They're just a few minutes each, so if you're looking for a show to fill time between these Warriors episodes, I think you'll love the Medal of Honor podcast. Search for the Medal of Honor podcast wherever you get your shows. Thanks. I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. In partnership with The Honor Project, we've brought this podcast back at a time when our nation needs these stories more than ever. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for listening, and by doing so, honoring those who have served. Today, we'll hear from Quartermaster Second Class and former Navy SEAL, Brett Jones. Jones served on SEAL Team 8, which at the time was the most active SEAL team. After almost being kicked out of the SEALs, Jones decided to leave the teams and join the CIA. There, he deployed to Iraq to protect people in high-threat environments.
So, my name is Brett Jones. I got in the Navy, I think it was in end of 93. My rate when I got in was a personnelman, and then I ended up switching it to a quartermaster, and because it was easier at the time being a SEAL to take those tests. And then I got out as a QM2, or quartermaster second class. Well, I remember the first time I heard about Navy SEALs, and it was a conversation that my father had had with my brother. We were living in Egypt at the time. My dad was military, and they were talking about these people that had come to the embassy, and my dad wasn't even allowed to see their faces. And I was like, oh man, my dad's a colonel. Who are these people? And I just listened in on that conversation, and I was just fascinated by these people. Turns out later it was actually... I think it was Richard Marcinko's group that was out there at that time. But it was, it just fascinated me, and that planted a seed, I guess. As I got older, my family ended up finding out that I was gay, I think right around when I was 17 or somewhere in there. And it was not a very accepting atmosphere. And I got kicked out of the family, or out of the house anyways. And I remember thinking like how I wanted to be, I didn't want to be an unsuccessful person. For some reason that was really important to me at the time. And I thought that the best route that I could go that could show people that, you know, that this gay thing and like it was irrelevant to who I mean, it was important, obviously, that who I was, but it didn't make a difference in what I wanted to do with my life. And so I joined the Navy, and and I went through SEAL training. I didn't make it my first time, which was devastating to me at the time. And I went to Iceland for 2 years, and there I got a refocus, largely in part to some friends of mine that I had had. And knew that I was gay, that were also in the military and there with me in Iceland, and that compassion that they showed me, because I think at the time I was really I was conflicted a lot. I still carried a lot of that resentment and that pain that, you know, my parents and maybe intentionally, maybe unintentionally, you know, that coming out like that is very difficult, and it weighs on you emotionally. And so that experience of not making it through SEAL training and being with those people in Iceland was a very healing experience for me. And I got refocused, and I went back to SEAL training, and then that time I made it. I quit. I totally quit. And it's funny, there was this guy, Master Chief Chalker. And so it was the first night of Hell Week, and we were being surf torture, which is where, you know, you lock your arms and you lay in the ocean, and it's just really cold, and you just sit there for what feels like an eternity. And it had been weeks of that leading up to it, and I just wasn't ready. I didn't know going into it what a SEAL was supposed to, I was very naive. And I remember I quit, and as I was leaving the ranks of this, being surf tortured, Master Chief Chalker, who was a legend there at the time, was like, let him go. And then he came out to like tell them to let me go, because I was trying to, you know, quit. And my buddies were like, no, don't quit, Brett. And then him coming out, like he face planted right in the surf. And yeah, you just had to know his temperament and this person to understand what a big deal that was. And I rang the bell. I wasn't ready. I was not ready. Like, physical pain is a very temporary thing, mostly, right? And I think when you go through something as emotionally hard as like coming out the way that I did, and a lot of people, you know, I'm not any one special. I mean, my coming out was nowhere near as bad as a lot of people's. But it builds something in you, right? Like a strength when you make it through a situation like that and you process. And here's the thing, like the difference between like emotional and physical stuff is that the physical stuff is temporary. And even though at times it doesn't seem like it is, but the emotional stuff is like something that takes a whole lot more work on your part later down the road to heal from. But you ultimately do, if you do that work, become a much stronger person. And I think that was what Iceland did for me, was made me a much stronger person emotionally. And then the physicality of it, you know, you just have to be in good shape. And that's relatively the easy part of making it through SEAL training. The difficult part of SEAL training is the emotional aspect of it. And it is as you know, going through some challenging courses that the military offers requires that emotional strength. And so I was much better equipped. And I learned also to really focus just on what was happening to me at the moment, and not to focus at the monstrous mountain that was still left to climb. It was just, okay, I'm cold and I'm really hungry and I'm tired, but this is my moment right now, and I know it's going to end. It has to end in an hour, 2 hours, or at the latest when the sun comes up and brings the warmth and all that stuff that comes with that. And so that was what I really tried to do, is focus on that. And then I also had some like mental tricks where I would try to create a story in my mind while all this, you know, cold and whatever stuff was happening around me, I would just try to create a story in my mind, or say the ABCs backwards, or say the ABCs and think of a friend that begins with every single letter of, you know, just whatever I could do to get my mind off of how miserable, out of my own self, right? Like whatever I could do to get out of that negative pattern that happens when things are not going your way. It was the end of Wednesday night and the beginning of Thursday. And when the sun came up Thursday morning, I was like, oh, hell yeah. You ain't going to stop me now. And because there's like the way that Hell Week works is, it's at least in my recollection of it, it was very physically
just super duper hard in the first 2-3 days where it's just cold and they're yelling and it's just, it's nonstop. And I remember at Wednesday night, there was this evolution that we did that where you just start to kind of zone out and you start to just get into this like automatic mode. And you're so sleep deprived and, you know, you're not yourself. And somehow, like when that sun comes up Thursday morning, I was just like, all right, I've got this. And yeah, and everything was just on cruise control from that point till Friday afternoon. So I graduate and basically they give you, you can put in what they call a dream sheet, which is you can request which teams you want to go to. And back then, everyone wanted to go to the teams that were the most chances of you actually going out and doing real world stuff. And at that time, it was SEAL Team 8. And so I chose, obviously, my first pick was SEAL Team 8. And oddly enough, I got it, and which was super exciting. Then I went from BUDS, because technically you're still not a SEAL yet. So I had to go to Army's Airborne School, where I learned my first lesson about Army schools and that the Army can suck the fun out of anything, even something as fun as jumping out of planes, they make it miserable. And so that was like, I guess, 3 weeks long or something like that. And then you go to your SEAL team. And then this is, you know, obviously it's changed a little bit since I was in, but you would go to your SEAL team and you do something called SEAL tactical training, which was this advanced form of everything that you've learned up until this point. And for some reason, I remember that being right around 6 months. I think the training was right around 4 months. But by the time I got there, waited for that class to start and, you know, that whole process. And then you have to go through this really big test where basically they have these, you know, salty old SEALs that are in this room, and you walk into this room and they have maps and, you know, all kinds of guns completely disassembled, radios over in this corner, just everything that, you know, you would need to know and do as a SEAL. And they quiz you on everything. And it's usually a very hard test. I mean, you're plotting stuff on maps while you're answering questions from this guy that are completely have nothing to do with what you're doing right here. And it's a very stressful and long. I remember mine being in the neighborhood of, I mean, we broke even for food and then we came back. So I think it was right around like 6 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours. It was really long and super stressful. And then at the end, they make me stand out in this hall while they all deliberate on whether or not they believe I'm ready to get my trident. And here's the thing, like, if you don't get that, if you don't pass that, then that could be it. You have made it all the way to this point and you're done. Or they may give you another chance or you get your trident. So it's a very, it's just really stressful. And I went back into that room and they're like, okay, you're good. And I was like, oh my God. And then the next morning they pinned me in front of the whole SEAL team and it was a really awesome experience. And then at that point I'm officially a SEAL. And then they put you in a platoon, and the platoon is usually between 14 and 16 guys. And then those group of guys are your family for the next year and a half. So you'll spend a year training with them or thereabouts, sometimes a little more. And it's all about sending you to different schools and then you all training together as a team. And so that's what that whole year is about. And it's intense and it's fast paced and it's really intense. And then you deploy for 6 months and you do, you know, what you've been training that whole time to do. So the Navy was really messed up then, right? It's not that way anymore. Like now SEALs have their own rates, but back then SEALs didn't. And so I would, I first was a personnel man, which was like a secretary, really, to be honest with you. And that was what the Navy trained me to be. But once I got to the SEAL teams, I was like, there's no way I can study for this and have it apply to any, like, it was just a huge inconvenience to study for something that I had nothing, you know, to do with. And so I thought the easiest one for me to do would be a quartermaster, since a lot of it is just navigating. And basically that's what you do a lot of as a SEAL. So I went to quartermaster A school when I was a SEAL, And also at that time, when you went to take your test, they would give you like some points or a break or something like that because you were a SEAL. And because they knew that you weren't gonna be able to study or you didn't work in your field. So they cut you a little bit of slack.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Ah, gosh, my first deployment was what they call a strike platoon, and I was my team was put on the Eisenhower battle group, and so we would go and do stuff from the Eisenhower, and then we would fly back and, you know, recoup and regroup and get all of our stuff cleaned up and ready, and then we would deploy again from that carrier to wherever, to do whatever, for how long. And then, you know, it was just six months of that. Although, like, we didn't spend a whole lot of time on the carrier. I mean, I think the longest we spent on that thing was maybe 2 weeks. And, but then you're off doing something else, and which was really nice because I didn't like spending much time on those ships. This whole time, like, I'm going through SEAL training and all this stuff leading up to this. I'm thinking once I get there, then, like, I'm a movie star, man. I don't have to do anything. I just go be a cool guy and do cool guy stuff or whatever. And that's not, I don't know where that idea came from. But when I got there, the competition gets even more intense. The op level gets even more intense. That was what was shocking to me, was it wasn't this thing that I, this Hollywood thing that I guess I had in my head, and it was actual, like, really hard work to not only stay in the SEAL teams, but to be a contributing, you know, a good contributor to the team. So that was what was surprising to me. Pre-9/11 was, it was a lot of recon stuff and a lot of JSETs, a lot of training. It wasn't like as action-y as, when I went to go work for the CIA. But there were, I mean, we did do some pretty cool stuff. There was there was the whole Iraq and Iran, you know, that situation was happening. And so what was going on was they were smuggling oil out of Iraq and then selling it. It was funding the, you know, that movement out there. And so we were taking down those, they were called maritime interdiction operations. And so we were taking down those ships, which was, you know, that was real exciting. That was actually, I feel like, a really great introduction into the SEAL experience. There was this space of water where these boats had to go into international waters for brief. It was like less than maybe 10 nautical miles. It has been a while, so I can't remember exactly. And then it would bounce right into Iranian water. So it was this very difficult, very fast-paced, like, get in there, take control of the ship, and take it, you know, further out into international waters where it was turning over to NATO, and then that oil gets, I don't know how, whatever NATO does with all that stuff is their thing. Yeah, it was intense. And I remember one op in particular where we took down the boat, and they tried to scuttle the ship, which, you know, dump all that oil out into the ocean. I mean, they wanted to make a big, you know, international incident out of it. And so our team, we had to work fast and quick, and it was amazing what some of the guys on our team were able to do to take control of that ship and steer it, even without the hydraulic systems and the, I mean, they really tried to make that ship impossible to steer. And we actually started floating very well. I don't know, like, what I can say about that op from that point on, but it got really crazy as far as, you know, borders go and getting that boat into NATO hands. So if there's fast rope, usually what we would do is we would have a team that would fast rope onto the superstructure of the ship, and then we would have a team come up on a rib or on a swick boat, and they would come on that way. So one team would take control of the bridge, and then the other team would go in and take control of the half steering, and because that's another place where you can control the ship just like you can the bridge. And then also, and then they would, you know, break off into teams where they would go and round up the crew and take control of the crew and put them in a safe space where they couldn't try and do things like dump, you know, millions of gallons of oil into the ocean. I remember how we trained, and I remember we had like one of this gnarly crash, because we ended up using, at the time, it was just whatever asset we could use at the time. And I don't know how this happened, but because this was way above my head, but we ended up with one of the Helix, and it's the dual rotor, that's the 47, right? Our 46, yeah, thank you. So we ended up with one of those, and it was the one that would bring the mail to the different ships. And it was the only one we had available at the time. And so, yeah, and that was turned out to be just an awful, awful mistake, because, you know, when you're flying a helicopter to get on a ship, especially a ship that's trying to ditch you, you have to stay relative with that ship as it's doing all these cuts and corners and stuff like that. I'm not a pilot. You would know better than I would, but it was proved to be a very challenging thing for somebody that isn't used to that. And on one of the just getting ready to do those maritime interdiction operations, the helicopter clipped the AFN antenna on a USNS ship that we were practicing on, and then it just ended up crashing into the superstructure of the ship, and all the blades flew off, and we had, at the time, I want to say we had two platoons on that practicing for that one. But it was weird, like, nobody got hurt, and like, if you would have seen how high that superstructure was and where it hit and then slid down, and, you know, you would think, man, somebody, if not multiple people, are going to be dead. And nobody. And I happened to be the first person to fast rope off of that one, because I was a breacher and under the superstructure. And then somebody else fast rope behind me, and then it clipped the thing, and then it came down. And yeah. So right after 9/11 happened, I deployed with SEAL Team 8 in like 2 weeks. It was so fast. But what was crazy is we were already scheduled to deploy at that time anyways. So we had already had everything packed, and it was crazy. It was just boom. And we were out the door. And when I came back
from that deployment, everyone that was in that deployment with me went to SEAL Team 10 to commission SEAL Team 10, which is basically, you know, creating a whole new SEAL team. And that's basically what happened, is we went from being SEAL Team 8 one day to the minute we got back from that deployment to being SEAL Team 10. And I didn't get to do a whole lot of work with SEAL Team 10. In fact, it was just a few months that I was there before they found out about, you know, me being gay. We did do stuff, but we weren't where we wanted to be. Let me put it that way. So here's the basis of what happened. So the Navy finds out that I'm gay. I go through that whole investigation process, and basically everything gets, all my clearances, everything get pulled, and I even had to be escorted on my team. It was really just an overall embarrassing, and the way that I was, it is just an awful experience. I eventually get cleared, and I remember my SEAL team commander, or the CEO of our SEAL team, took me into his office because he was a very big supporter of mine, which I'll forever be grateful for, him and our Master Chief. And they brought me in the office, and they're like, "Hey man, we're all good. It's done." Apparently, you know, a call from a senator makes all the difference in the world. And what do you want to do? Do you want to, because we can throw you in a platoon right now, get you out the door. And this was in 2003. So you have to kind of think about the time frame, right? The repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell was still, you know, years and years away. And to me at the time, it looked like it was never going to have that was never going to be a thing. And there were people that knew that I was gay now, like it wasn't a secret. And there was high ranking people that knew that I was gay. And I just honestly felt that it would be a matter of time before, you know, anything, something, I don't know. It was just as difficult as my life had been in the Navy up until that point with them, you know, with the whole investigation of me being gay and all that, I couldn't imagine what it would be like for another, you know, who knows, you know, another 10 years until I retired. So I decided to get out. And I feel even to this day, that was the best thing that I could have done at that time, given, you know, the time frame and everything going on. And the CIA recruited me like almost instantly. I got out, and I was actually technically still in the Navy because I was on my terminal leave. I had 2 months of terminal leave, and I was working at some, I've always been really fascinated with the movie making process and filmmaking and all that. And so I went to go work for this small little production company, and I got recruited by the agency. They're like, "Hey, we have this program. It's called, they called them GRS agents back then. And it was basically a global response, part of their global response staff." And so I went and I did it. I went through their application process. It was very fast and furious. I mean, from the minute I said yes, I was in a training program just a couple weeks later. And then right after that, I was on a plane to Iraq. And I was still, crazy enough, I was still in the Navy serving in Iraq for the agency. And I was one of the first guys to get my clearance. I remember they did these clearances really quick back then because they just needed people. And I remember I was like brutally honest. I was like, "Look, man, I'm gay. I'm in a relationship with, I own a house where, you know, this and that, and with this guy doing the background investigation." And I thought for sure that I would never get my clearance. But I mean, 2 days after landing in Iraq, they came in and said, "Hey, your top secret clearance came through." It's like, damn, that's quick. It's basically protecting people in high threat environments is really what the baseline of it is. Now, it gets complicated on different mission levels and all that sort of stuff. But basically, it's going in, working with, you know, people within the agency who are trained to meet with and talk with shady people. And our job was to go with them or bring them or to pick up for them shady people. And that was
That was really, it was just protecting, it was all about keeping people alive was what that job was, which was very rewarding, actually. Unfortunately, there aren't any examples that I can share, but I can tell you that the difference between sort of working as a Navy SEAL and then going and working for the agency was, so at a SEAL team, you have your operators, right? You have your Navy SEALs, and then you have the support people that, you know, help, you know, with the administrative side and the motors, just all, you know, this whole support staff behind these SEALs. And the difference being when I was with the agency is that support was much bigger and it wasn't felt as like, oh, we were the ones that, it was more of a team. It felt very much, the team felt much bigger and much wider. And you know, the agency, you know, we would fight for a lot of little things in the SEAL teams, believe it or not, like things like new weapons or new sight systems and, you know, things like that. Whereas at the agency, it honestly at times felt like all I had to do was ask for something and I would get it, no matter how, you know, how much it might have cost. Oh, the guy that drove in and blew himself up. Yes, I was in during that. In fact, one of the guys that was killed, one of the GRS guys, was a really good friend of mine. We went through what we call TDC together. It's this very difficult training that you had to do every year at the time to stay in that program. And and it's really sad. I saw a movie, like he was depicted in some movie. I can't remember. Or maybe 13? No. God, it wasn't 13 yet. I remember watching that and just feeling that same damn sinky feeling that where, you know, like it feels like your heart disappears out of your chest. And then there's like that void or whatever when that day, golly, that was awful. And I remember a guy that I worked with who they were actually, because he was a cop in Atlanta or somewhere around Atlanta. And I remember they had him and this other cop that were on the program had worked together. They were in the military and then they got out, were cops and then went and did this whole thing with the agency and had been cops together. I remember his reaction because we were roommates at the time when we heard and fuck, man, I don't know how to like describe it to you other than it was literally like having something in you just disappear instantly. And then, you know, the emotions and how you deal with that. It was awful. It was an awful fucking day. I saw the person get smoked. That was sort of the head one after that. And, you know, you think something like that would bring you sort of peace and, you know, ending or whatever to it, and it didn't. So I think fortunately at the time that happened, I was deployed when it happened. So I was around, you know, people that we could talk about it with. But even then, there's this whole bravado that you have to try to maintain that you're strong and this and that. And I remember I was in a relationship at the time and that person was what we call read in, right? Which means that I could talk to them about things like that. I don't know. Like it's a loss, man. It's like, you know, it's like losing a brother, right? Like you can talk. I mean, sure. Yes. Talking does help. I don't mean to discourage talking. But a part of that is just time. It's just time and patience and even today I get choked up thinking about it because it still, even today, hurts a little bit for sure. I miss them. And, I try to, in those moments, focus on the things that I really enjoyed about them. And I want to say that the most, you know, beautiful examples of leadership that I have seen are always people that, one, aren't afraid or don't, it's not even a matter of afraid or not, but do the same thing and you know will do the same thing that you're being asked to do, but also the ones that have compassion and love, really. I mean, I don't
we want to make it sound corny or anything like that, but it's there is a whole lot of leadership lessons to be learned in compassion. And I think those are those examples that I had seen, and you know, throughout my whole career and even now, are the ones that I really try to emulate and to be like. Is those who were fierce but also compassionate.
That was Quartermaster Second Class Brett Jones. To hear more from him, check out his book, Pride, the story of the first openly gay Navy SEAL. Thanks for listening to Warriors in Their Own Words. If you have any feedback, please email the team at kharbaugh@evergreenpodcasts.com. We're always looking to improve the show. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review. Warriors in Their Own Words is a production of Evergreen Podcasts in partnership with The Honor Project. Our producer is Declan Roars. Bridget Coyne is our production director, and Sean Ruhlhoffman is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Evergreen executive producers Joan Andrews, Michael DeAloya, and David Moss. I'm Ken Harbaugh, and this is Warriors in Their Own Words.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.